The creation of a French Third Republic was an incidental factor in the political life of France, one that followed the national cataclysm of the Franco-Prussian War and the failure to restore the Comte de Chambord as Henry V of France. Nevertheless, the French Third Republic would go on to rehabilitate the legacy of the French Revolution and establish France's most enduring regime since the fall of Louis XVI, normalizing France's republican identity while still immersed in a sea of European monarchies. United in opposition to German ascendancy in Europe, France would not only triumph against Germany in the Great War, but spread the French political system across Europe from Portugal to Czechoslovakia. The triumph of the Third Republic is less remarked than the Napoleonic Wars, though perhaps the former had a more profound impact on the political landscape. Despite the refashioning of Europe to suit French interests, France of the interwar languished untested, the strength of her army concealing a dissolving nation. A dissolving nation that was unprepared and unwilling to seriously confront a new and reascendant Germany. A Germany that dealt the triumphant France its most humiliating defeat in history. The defeat was such that the Third Republic now exists in popular memory as the interlude between catastrophes. Following the second national cataclysm, a France in ruins was confronted with the Third Republic's ultimate legacy of failure and established a new France, a regime that rather than reform the Republic, chose to abolish it. Rehabilitating France's Catholic legacy, treading the thin line between national reorganization and Axis collaboration, while lingering under the spectre of illegitimacy. Today I'll be delving into Vichy France on the ruin of the Third French Republic. The consolidation of the Third Republic begins with the White Flag Crisis. There is a video to this topic linked in the description. To paraphrase parts of that presentation, after the fall of Emperor Napoleon III, the expectation in France was for a restoration of the monarchy under the arch-Catholic Henry, Comte de Chambord. This restoration did not come to fruition, after which the Catholic and monarchist right in France instead looked for temporary relief in their regent-president MacMahon, who in the aftermath of the White Flag Crisis was given a 7-year mandate as head of state. In a crisis eerily similar to the cohabitation of recent governments of the Fifth Republic, the National Assembly became increasingly republican, to the point that in 1876, MacMahon was forced to appoint a government led by secular republicans. The one issue on which the moral order of MacMahon would not compromise was the support of Pius IX and the papacy, known as the Roman Question. When the President and the Prime Minister contradicted each other on this policy in 1877, it not only produced a constitutional crisis, but it represented a galvanizing moment in the history of France, whereafter to be on the left was to be a secularist and to be on the right was to be a Catholic, as the dynastic pretensions of the monarchist factions gradually faded. The President appointed a new government under Broglie and hoped to win a mandate in elections the same year to the National Assembly, which instead produced a Republican majority. In 1879, a Republican majority was produced in the French Senate as well. Anxious to prevent a coup, the government began interfering in military appointments. With the army under attack, MacMahon resigned rather than risk civil war. He was succeeded by the first Republican president, Jules Grévy, with Léon Gambetta as the president of the Chamber of Deputies and later prime minister. Symbols of the First Republic, notably the anthem, La Marseillaise, were restored. By the time of Chambord's death in 1883, and following also Napoleon the Prince Imperial's death in 1879, monarchism in France, whatever the dynasty, was no longer practicable. Even before the death of Chambord, a proposal was carrying through the Assembly to banish the princes of France. In the end, the law of exile amounted to nothing more than an act of petty vindictiveness that exposed the impotence of French monarchism after the dashed hopes of 1873. Indeed, it exposed the impotence of the French right, who were forced to cling to populists like Boulanger. The government dealt with the Catholic Church in a similar vein to their response to the French princes, eliminating their influence over education and then liquidating the last vestiges of the Napoleonic Concordat with Prime Minister Emile Combes' separation of church and state, spurred off the back of the Dreyfus affair. What united the secularists with the remnant and permissible elements of the French right was revanche, the mission of the Third Republic to reclaim Alsace-Lorraine, those regions sundered from Germany with the Republic's original foundation in 1871, and defeat at the hands of Prussia-Germany. France's Catholic faction, politically ascendant until 1877, was forced underground. Divested of its formal monarchist trappings, the Catholic faction coalesced, ultimately, around Charles Maurras and the new movement, Action Française. The thought of Charles Maurras deserves its own dedicated video, perhaps with the thought of Hannah Arendt serving as a counterpoint. As it so happens, this video on Vichy France has ended up as a single episode in yet another mini-series on this channel, the series inquiring into the post-revolutionary thought of the French right. Though it may be a retroactive step for this mini-series, I hope to return to the topic of Action Française. For this video, I will briefly summarise its significance. Action Française was the legacy movement of French Catholic royalism, combined to the nationalism and anti-Jewishness of the anti-Dreyfusards. While Boulangerism, alluding to General Boulanger, General Revanche or Revenge, represented a sort of soft Caesarism, which was in turn the first major obstacle to the Third Republic, after the failure of the moral order of MacMahon, Action Française departed from the populism of Boulangerism to become an intellectual elite movement. All reactionary traditionalist movements of the 19th century, from de Maistre in France to Uvarov in Russia, were in a sense postmodern, as later distilled and understood by Nietzsche, espousing values that were eternal, organic, and historically contingent, yet in opposition to the rationalising and universalist impulse of the French Revolution. The rift in historically contingent societies had already occurred, and the mission of the reactionary was to mend the rift, restoring tradition where the original link had been broken. As an organic process, or at least ostensibly, such truth to be found in traditionalism was meant as self-evident and unconscious, an unconscious phenomenon, and yet it required an intellectual movement to reinvigorate it. For Maurras, the movement to represent this reinvigoration was Catholic integralism. The bedrock of society was the family, combined to social justice espoused by Catholic doctrine. Doctrine which found new coherence in the social encyclicals formulated in the 1880s and 1890s by Pope Leo XIII. Monarchy was the natural and historical government of France. Thus, the Third Republic must cease as an unnatural aberration. And yet, Maurras was a follower of the positivism of Comte. Indeed, his Catholic integralism combined positivism with idolatry for Louis XIV. As the tenets of Catholic integralism found their coherence in the first decades of the 20th century, the successors of the Dreyfusards were determined to eliminate the last vestiges of Catholic influence over the French state. Essentially, Dreyfusards were for the Republic, pro-Jewish in a sense, and secularist, whereas the anti-Dreyfusards were anti-Jewish Catholic nationalists. The apparent hostility between Catholics and the Republic caused major divisions within French Catholicism itself. Indeed, Action Française can be considered as much as a reaction to the temporal outlook of Leo XIII as it was to the aggressive secularising efforts of the radical Republicans Dreyfusards. Catholic progressives pursued a policy of reliement, rallying to the Republic in the belief that popular Catholic acceptance of the regime would help extinguish the regime's growing institutional antipathy towards the Church. To the horror of French monarchists, Leo XIII conceded Reliement in 1892 to accept the Republic, to submit to it as representing power come from God. The Dreyfus Affair and the pontificate of the conservative Pius X reinvigorated Catholic opposition to the Republic, rendering Reliement untenable to the extent that diplomatic relations between France and the papacy were ruptured. The First World War had the effect of temporarily legitimizing the Third Republic among the left and the Catholic right. In the wake of the Republic's victory over the monarchies of Germany and Austria-Hungary, the pontificate of Pius XI launched a second Reliement, restoring relations with the French government. Indeed, Pius XI went so far as to formally disown and condemn Action Française in 1926, where his predecessor, Pius X, had actively favoured the movement only two decades prior. Despite Pius XI's favour of Reliement, and the fact that his pontificate would last until 1939, it was not enough to prevent the second rise of Catholic integralism, as the movement acquired a new notoriety in the 1930s, coinciding, if not aligning, with Italian fascism and German National Socialism. The Third Republic was now squeezed by the extremes of the communist left and the right-leaning leagues. Throughout the 1930s, the Republic meandered from crisis to crisis, as governments collapsed in quick succession, though with some notable mainstays alternating in the office of Prime Minister, such as Pierre Laval, Léon Blum, and Édouard Daladier. Collectively, these governments were impotent in defending the gains of France in the First World War, vis-à-vis the growing power of National Socialist Germany. Despite the size and reputation of the victorious French army, the Tsar, a French protectorate, rejoined Germany. The Rhineland was reoccupied by the German army, having been vacated by French and Belgian troops years prior. In 1938, France, at the prompting of Great Britain, abandoned her principal military and ideological ally in Central Europe, Czechoslovakia, the linchpin of the French-aligned Little Entente. Attempts to detach Italy and the Soviet Union from Germany failed miserably. In 1936, following the invasion of Ethiopia, Italy joined the Rome-Berlin Axis. In 1939, Germany concluded the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact with the Soviet Union, leaving France with no continental allies when she declared war on Germany alongside Great Britain in September of 1939. It is telling that the defence of France was left to Maurice Gamelin, a man whom it transpired had no intention of seizing the initiative in the early stages of the war, leaving Poland to its fate, content to merely await events. Gamelin's position was predicated on his political beliefs, for he was committed to the Third Republic, and his command over the army ensured its loyalty to the regime in Paris, if not its effectiveness against German invasion, an invasion which began in May of 1940. As France's defeat had become a near certainty only weeks later, the government of France was given to another military figure, a war hero, a man who made no secret of his disdain for the Republic by the 1930s and 40s, Marshal Philippe Pétain. To understand Vichy, we must look back to the career of Pétain. Prior to the Great War, Pétain, the soldier, had an unremarkable career. Indeed, it seems certain in early 1914 that the 58-year-old colonel would soon retire, having never risen to the rank of general. Nevertheless, Pétain quickly demonstrated tactical brilliance in the early stages of the German advance, receiving a battlefield promotion to general after the Battle of Guise, and shortly after, commanding a division at the First Battle of the Marne and the Second Army after the Guise offensive. It had taken Pétain 32 years to reach the rank of colonel in the peacetime army. It took less than 2 years for Pétain to go from commanding a brigade to commanding 52 divisions in the wartime army. During the Battle of Verdun, Pétain was widely credited and venerated for his role in organising the Voies Sacrées, to the besieged French forces of Verdun, ensuring that French artillery power was sufficient to halt the German offensive. A year later, Petain was appointed commander-in-chief of the French army, in whose capacity he successfully ended the mutinies of 1917, though he was succeeded by General Foch for the concluding offences of the war. Though Foch was France's greatest strategist, Petain was widely regarded as France's superlative defensive tactician, and was awarded the distinction of Marshal of France, one of three, alongside Foch and Joseph Joffre. Throughout the 1920s and 30s, the French army underwent a process of significant downsizing and budgetary cuts, while military conscription was scaled back, a development that Petain bitterly opposed, coming to early conflict with Édouard Daladier, who was the most vocal proponent of spending cuts. Believing now that the French army was incapable of offensive operations, Petain oversaw the construction of the Maginot Line fortifications between France's border with Germany. In 1934, in the wake of riots with the Republic on the brink of collapse, Petain was invited into the government as Minister of War by then-President Lebrun. To combat the perceived collapse in soldier morale, Petain insisted on adding education to his ministerial portfolio, believing that a reinvigoration of morals was a prerequisite to an effective national defence. With the collapse of the government, he refused to stay on as Minister of War, though it was already widely touted that Petain may have to assume dictatorial powers, given the crisis of the Republic. Petain would be a unity candidate, appealing primarily to the right, but to elements also on the left. Though of the intuitive right, Petain was hardly a Catholic integralist or a monarchist. Instead, he was principally concerned with the rise of communism and any attempt by France to ally with the Soviet Union. Within France itself, the period of 1936 to 1940, the era of Blum and Daladier of the Radical Party, represented the most dramatic and, as it transpired, divisive advance of socialism in French history. Though the Republic was in its final year, the left had produced a mirage of full-spectrum dominance, the culmination of successive triumphs against the reactionaries since the fall of MacMahon over 60 years ago. Yet as a mirage, it was soon to be exposed and crushed by the sensation of total military defeat at the hands of Germany. Shortly following the German invasion of France, Petain was appointed deputy prime minister to bolster French morale, an insufficient and belated gesture. With France's fate sealed, the government of Paul Reynaud resigned, leaving Petain as prime minister. 5 days later, Petain concluded an armistice with Germany at Compiègne. France had signed a separate peace with Germany. Britain continued the war. Petain's protégé, Charles de Gaulle, rallied France to the cause of the Allies and an anti-German resistance, though Petain represented the legal government of France, a France which was nominally neutral. Despite this, northern and western France, the Atlantic coastline, along with Paris, was given up to German occupation. The government of the Third Republic relocated to the southern spa town of Vichy. There, a full congress of the French legislature, the deputies and the Senate, voted to end its own existence, effectively ending the French Third Republic. A French state was declared, a state so named to distance itself from the revolutionary legacy of the Republic, with Pétain as its chief of state. The swift defeat of France was a total invalidation of the Third Republic. France's reactionaries had been gifted an opportunity, but at a tremendous cost. The attempt to contest the legacy of the French Revolution, to augment aspects of the Action Française platform and broader elements of the French right to Petainism, the cult of the mythologized Maréchal as saviour, undergirded by the cult of Joan of Arc, to see travail, famille, patrie, work, family and nation, replace liberté, égalité, fraternité, all occurred under the watch of German occupation. Nationalism, since Boulanger and the anti-Dreyfusards, united the opposition to the Republic, as much as the fear of communism. Under these conditions, the reforms of the French state would carry with them the implication of German influence at the very least to treasonous collaboration at worst, a veritable sword of Damocles hanging over the French state. The state of France, therefore, had to walk a perilous tightrope. Under different circumstances, it is possible that Pétain, the octogenarian dictator, could have come to represent a French counterpart to Spain's Francisco Franco. Pétainism as Francoism, a union of anti-leftists, anti-republicans, under a military strongman. Instead, the Vichy experiment failed, ultimately rehabilitated the legacy of the Third Republic, set the stage for the Fourth and Fifth Republics, immortalised de Gaulle, the Resistance, and damned Pétain. I'm now going to be reading a summary of Vichy France, Old Guard and New Order by Robert Paxton, which, to my mind, is the definitive history in English of the Vichy government. The Vichy regime is the one experiment in governing modern France that is still mired in ill repute. Champions of other experiments have at least maintained audiences of fireside fantasizers nostalgic for past glories. Vichy evokes no such nostalgia. At the liberation, the partisans of General de Gaulle, the members of the internal resistance, and the ex-supporters of Pétain, and Frenchmen who had simply waited things out, all had their own reason to regard Vichy as a historical blind alley, down which a handful of misguided or wicked men had momentarily driven the nation. The restoration of the Republic, nearly everyone was eager to believe, meant that France had resumed its destined course. Emphasis on the discontinuities between the Vichy regime and the French experience before and after the war persisted. The Vichy regime, nevertheless, was no less rooted in French history than its predecessors, no less a contrivance of the dominant groups of French society, despite its brief duration, when compared to the long-lived Third Republic. Nevertheless, it was no less broadly supported, for a time, than previous or subsequent French experiments. And Vichy contributed more to the shape of the future than its critics have been willing to concede. But the fact remains that Vichy conducted all of its business, good and bad, under the eye of the German occupier. In Marcel Ufuhl's magnificent documentary film, The Sorrow and the Pity, Lord Avon, Anthony Eden, remarks that he doubts whether anyone who did not live in France under the German occupation has the right to set himself in judgment of those who did. In the case of the millions of ordinary Frenchmen who endeavoured only to survive, to ride out the storm as best they could, it is impossible not to concur. Whether Lord Avon's forbearance in the matter of judgment can be extended to the makers of policy is another matter. Questions of the degree to which the men of Vichy were responsible for things that happened in France between 1940 and 1944, of what moved them to act as they did, and whether they could have acted otherwise, cannot be avoided. At the bottom, the decisive reason holding men to the Vichy solution was an instinctual commitment to public order as the highest good. From the day that the last Parliament of the Third Republic voted full powers to Pétain, almost to the day that the Germans hauled the protesting marshal off to Sigmaringen, fear of disorder dominated the French policy of the Vichy regime and shaped its conduct of internal affairs. The French elites had been well schooled in the connection between war and revolution. The Paris Commune of 1871 had announced the intimacy of this relationship. Insurrection in the wake of military defeat prefigured the pattern of revolution in the 20th century. Well before 1914, the military and political leadership of the Third Republic had begun to lay elaborate plans against such a contingency. With the disaster of 1940, the day when chaos would thrust opportunities into the hands of revolutionaries, indeed that day seemed to have arrived. Thus, in the summer of defeat, the able wire-pullers and arm-twisters, Pierre Laval, the former Prime Minister, had no need to exercise his arts. Full powers were not pried and cajoled from Parliament. The overwhelming support accorded to Pétain was freely given. When called to account for their actions, the men of Vichy insisted on the passivity of the regime in its dealings with Germany. The image of policymakers prodded to do the Germans' bidding, dragging their feet, then giving way to unbearable pressures, has persisted. The men of Vichy aimed to replace the armistice of 1940 with a peace treaty recognizing the sovereignty of France and French autonomy over internal affairs. In exchange for an equal place in the new Europe, France would act to keep the British out of the French Empire and to contribute militarily and provide naval aid towards a final German victory. But Hitler was not interested in the scheme. He wanted docility, loot, and perhaps bases, not cooperation among potential equals. Nevertheless, efforts to obtain a peace treaty from the Germans in exchange for favours done persisted to the eve of the Allied landings in Normandy. The idea that after 1942, the men of Vichy, especially Pétain, lost their enthusiasm for collaboration and engaged in a waiting game has no foundation. Nor does the notion that Pétain played one tune, Laval another, and Delanne yet a third. All of them played variations on a single theme. To be sure, their policy had become a desperate gamble by the winter of 1942, however reasonable it may have seemed in the summer of 1940. Still, they preferred the risks of continued collaboration with the Germans to the risks of insurrection that they feared an Allied landing might bring. Fears of social revolution meant fear of communism. Anti-Bolshevism is the nearest thing to a Vichy common denominator. This was a roomy antipathy indeed. Everyone from a pacifist trade unionist of a revolutionary syndicalist variety to reactionaries of every fringe could find a place within this broad spectrum. It has been some time since anyone described Vichy as a monolith, but confusion about the character and composition of the regime has persisted. The defeat of 1940 presented the new regime with a nearly unprecedented opportunity to undertake change, but those who rushed on stage when the curtain rose at Vichy had the most disparate ideas of what ought to be done. No short essay can convey the subtleties of the various distinctions of the competing visions of the good of France. Some of these visions were wildly incompatible. It was impossible to reconcile the moral order of the Catholic integrists, for example, with the fascist fantasies of a figure like Robert Brisson. But others had enough points of contact to establish a pattern of ideas which came to dominate the National Revolution. The pattern will surprise those who think of the National Revolution as an affair of traditionalists seeking revenge on the ideas of the Enlightenment and the principles of the French Revolution. A form of traditionalism did set the tone at Vichy, but it was not the traditionalism strictly of the Maurrassians and other who exalted the virtues of a pre-industrial order. The National Revolution was a heresy of the Third Republic liberal and progressive doctrines, not a repudiation of the Enlightenment then, but a reinterpretation of it. Traumatized by the experience of the 1930s, the architects of the National Revolution rejected parliamentarism and laissez-faire economics as instruments worthless in a crisis, but they retained the nationalistic and scientistic outlook of the 19th century Republicans, their belief in the malleability of the social order, their faith in education, their commitment to material progress, their urge to supplant class struggle with social harmony, and their view of France as a microcosm. The men of Vichy were bent on making the most of their opportunities. No other defeated state set out as ambitiously during World War II on such fundamental changes. Decrees poured forth in torrents as the regime sought to undertake reforms in nearly every corner of national life. It is already clear that in some aspects of national life, the regime's initiatives fell far short of expectations. The hierarchy of the Catholic Church, for example, had every reason to expect things from Vichy, but was in the end disappointed. those prelates who compromised themselves through their dealings with the political leadership came away empty-handed. In other areas, Vichy's reforms had consequences quite different from what many of their leading proponents intended. This discrepancy between intentions and results has misled some historians. They have taken the rhetorical flourishes of Vichy's ideologues too seriously. Theorists of peasant corporatism may have aimed to keep him down on the farm, just as some of their counterparts in industry yearned to create the traditional artisanate. Nevertheless, the relentlessness of economic trends, the constraints of wartime, and the influence of the powerful prevailed over nostalgia. Travail, patrie, famille was all very well as a motto. Modernization, organization, and efficiency better describe the process at work in agriculture and industry. In these realms, especially the experience of Vichy France, adumbrated the dominant trends of the post-war era. Well-intentioned as many of their initiatives doubtless were, the men of Vichy made the disastrous mistake of undertaking reforms in the presence of German occupation. In internal affairs, measures taken against some French citizens cast a shadow over measures taken in favour of others. In retrospect, the aspects of Vichy's domestic policy remain its handling of the Jewish question and its attitude towards the resistance. Indeed, anti-Jewishness was the black mark of the Vichy experience and that which has pervaded many histories since. Far from giving way to external pressures, the regime had already taken discriminatory measures well before the Germans concerned themselves with the status of Jews in France. Indeed, left themselves, the men of Vichy, whose anti-Jewishness rested on cultural and national bases, the legacy of the anti-Dreyfusards. But that is to say that the Germans and the French had radically different policy proposals regarding the Jewish question. Laval, rather successfully, evaded the National Socialist demands for Jews of French citizenship. Outside official circles, thousands of Jews found shelter in the homes of ordinary Frenchmen. Nevertheless, the fact remains that the Vichy government had tried to single out the Jews for special contempt and for measures of discrimination, and indeed these ultimately facilitated the German programmes. Vichy's attitude towards the resistance composed one more strand in the net of complicity which bound the regime ever tighter to the Germans. Behind the resistance, the men of Vichy perceived the threat of revolution. Fear of disorder came before all else. When the shooting of occupation troops began, the Germans did not need to prod Vichy into taking action against its own citizens. Vichy treated the resistors as outlaws, not patriots, and as many Frenchmen probably helped to hunt them down in the militia and other police organisations as joined the resistance. Not only did the French police collaborate with the German police, Vichy did nothing to stay the hand of vigilantes settling private scores of their own. But just who were the men of Vichy? The prominence of traditionalists in the purges of liberation gave rise to the myth of the predominantly traditionalist character of the Vichy governing apparatus. But the targets of the purges were the men in the most exposed positions, the apologists and propagandists of the regime, the ones, in short, who stuck their necks out. In fact, the regime's traditionalism was an illusion sustaining as the false fronts of a movie set. Deep within the hotels of Vichy, out of earshot of the marshal's adoring crowds, experts and professionals quietly went about the making of policy. In this respect, Vichy represents the triumph of the French counterparts of Albert Speer, the German arch-technocrat, over the politicians, those amateurs who had bungled things for years during the French Third Republic. No newcomers to the conduct of public affairs, the insiders of Vichy, had been insiders under the Third Republic. Members of the Grand Corps de l'État and experts from the private sector, men of essentially the same background and education. Laval's Minister of Internal Production, Jean Bichelon, first in his class at the École Polytechnique, engineer and enthusiastic moderniser and chef de cabinet of the Minister of Armaments in one of the last governments of the French Third Republic, can stand out as an example of these men, intellectually the ablest France had to offer. To judge Vichy is to judge the elite of France. The political, as well as the administrative elite, comes in for judgment. If technicians undertook at Vichy many of the functions which politicians had performed under the Third Republic, politicians did not drop from sight, although some would later wish that they had. To be sure, some of the old parliamentary notables, such as Edouard Herriot, had trundled off to the countryside under a form of house arrest. Nevertheless, the regime drew active support from almost the entire political spectrum of the Third Republic, not only from ideologues of the radical right, but also from renegades and heretics of the parliamentary and trade union left, the defeated and the disappointed of the bitter struggles of the 1930s, who hoped that some cherished scheme or other might at last be realised. By pursuing the ennuis of the state ministry and the yearbooks of the Grande École, noting the names which recur in them before and during the war years, one must lay to rest the fantasy that the Vichy regime was staffed and supported by men who sprang out of nowhere in 1940 and vanished as quickly from sight where once they had come. These were the men who maintained France, because of their actions, had at least escaped a worse fate. Such a conclusion was meant to be drawn from the famous sword and shield argument of Marshal Pétain and his defenders. Pétain acted as shield, staving off the executions of the Germans, while de Gaulle wielded the sword against them. And indeed, this idea of shield collaboration would later be appropriated by other governments who found themselves aligned or at the receiving end of German invasion. Serbia comes to mind. The Marshal's presence, the argument went, had saved France from Polandization and the rule of a Gauleiter. Not only had lives been spared, but the French were materially better off under Vichy than they would have been under German rule. This is one thesis that has found a sympathetic hearing among various historians. Eastern Europeans, in fact, ate better than the French did. Western Europeans in directly occupied countries were just as well nourished. Inflationary pressures were no less severe in France than elsewhere in National Socialist Germany's Europe. Despite the presence of a quasi-autonomous government, the Germans squeezed as much forced labour proportionally from France as they did from Belgium and Holland. Those Frenchmen who eluded deportation did so because they headed for the hills, not because of the shield which Vichy afforded them. Vichy's existence, then, did not force the Germans to make concessions. Vichy made concessions to the Germans as the price of his existence. What if the French had simply handed the government of the country over to the Germans, lock, stock and barrel, as Adolf Thiers supposedly threatened to do when he dealt with Bismarck in 1871? A Gauleiter would have made many French suffer, but in the end he might have gotten less from France. France required no Gauleiter. An elderly war hero, assisted by one of the most influential politicians of the Third Republic, and that being, of course, Pierre Laval, an eminent naval officer, that being Delon, and the flower of the French elite, all of whom were convinced that the maintenance of public order overrode any other conception of the national interest, served the Germans as well or better than any Gauleiter would have done. The recent snatching of Pétain's remains, and of course this is within the context of when this book came out in the 1970s, from their resting place on the Ile d'Yeu, served as a bizarre reminder of an era which many older people would probably just as soon forget. The majority of French, including the leader of these body snatchers, are too young to remember much, if anything, of World War II. Beyond a footnote in the history of the resistance and collaboration, the shame and consequence of France's original defeat, the Vichy experience has been all but forgotten, even in the context of France's other outlandish political experiments. its legacy has been repudiated, and French republicanism has ultimately been decisively and conclusively vindicated.